You are listening to the Middle East Institute's podcast series. To support MEI's programs and podcasts, please donate at www.mei.edu. Thank you for your support.
Ladies and gentlemen, we're ready to begin the morning's second panel. My name is Mark Sheeland. I'm Director of Programs and Government Relations for the Middle East Institute. Delighted to welcome you back from the break. Our second panel has the title Turkey, Iran, and the Gulf States, the challenges of rebuilding regional stability. We're very pleased and proud to have assembled the group that will be speaking to you for the next hour and a half or so, hour and a quarter, led by our moderator, Mr. Yaki Drizin. He's the news editor or managing editor of Foreign Policy with a team of 12 reporters covering foreign policy around the world. He's also the author of a very well-respected book, The Invisible Front, Love and Loss in the Era of Endless War. Highly recommended reading. He has an illustrious career as an embedded journalist and has covered warfare and other exigencies across the Middle East for a number of years. We're in very good hands with Yaki. I'm very pleased to introduce him to you and have him introduce our panelists and take you through this discussion. Yaki, over to you. Thank you.
Hi, good morning. Thank you all for coming. Thank you to the Middle East Institute for having me. Obviously, on a beautiful, sunny morning, few things more fun than sitting in a conference room, so we'll try to keep this as light and as lively as we can, given the somewhat serious topics we'll be discussing. But again, thank you all for coming out. I wanted to introduce the panel who'll be up here with me, starting with the gentleman to my left. And I'm going to get his last name right because I promised him I would. Jamal Khashoggi, because that name matters. He runs the Al Arab News Channel, which is a new 24-hour news channel, obviously in Arabic language, based out of Bahrain. Right. He has a background in print journalism, including in places like Afghanistan, where I spend quite a bit of time. He was the deputy editor-in-chief of Arab News, the leading English-language newspaper in Saudi Arabia, and is someone who both has an academic background and a journalistic background. It's a pleasure to have him on stage with me. To his left is Gunul Tal, who's the founding director of the Middle East Institute's Turkish Studies program. She's someone who has also taught and currently teaches at GW and authors a weekly column, making her another journalist, making me even happier that my dying profession has more of its representatives on this stage. To her left is Payam Mohseni, who's going to be talking a lot about Iran. He is someone who runs the Iran Project at the Harvard Kennedy School, also teaches at Harvard. He also travels frequently to Iran, which makes me extraordinarily jealous. My visa has been pending at the embassy in New York for 12 years. I send it birthday cards every year just to let it know I'm still thinking of it and have not forgotten. So my envy for him is rather considerable. And to his left, the final member of our panel is Abdulkhalik Abdullah, who's the chairman of the Arab Council for Social Science and a retired professor at Emirates University. He has taught at Georgetown, was a Fulbright scholar, and is an academic who's written widely on both Arab culture, the Arab Spring, and other issues of the sort. So again, welcome to all of them, and thanks again for all of you. I thought I would just start with the big news event that's coming up this weighs on me. As a journalist, it's kind of what weighs on me. We're trying to figure out different ways of covering it, which are the peace talks in Vienna. We can use peace with air quotes in theory, depending on your view. You can use talks and with air quotes in theory, depending on your view. There was a quote from John Kerry the last time describing how all the stakeholders for those talks were at the table, except, of course, for the stakeholder, which is the Syrian government, and the stakeholder, which is the Syrian opposition. But beyond that, they were all there. That said, you can look at these talks, I think, from a positive view that you do have the Saudis and the Iranians at the same table, even if it's tense. Or you could take the slightly more pessimistic view that they're at the same table, generally lobbing insults at each other, trying to sit in a way where they don't have to make eye contact, almost playing telephone and not speaking to each other directly. And it's a good prism, I think, and a good way to start the conversation. And I wonder if I could just start by asking each of you to say, do you take the positive view, the negative view, what might we expect from these talks, and also what might it lead to in terms of Saudi-Iranian relations?
Right. Thank you very much for inviting me again here. I'm not a big enthusiast about Vienna talk. I think Vienna talk are just the our exercise to show that we are doing something about Syria. What is truly happening in Syria is happening in the ground. It is true, as we heard from the previous panel, that the Russian intervention into Syria put some dynamism into the activities of various parties who are involved in Syria. But that dynamism, it is to move us from our accepting the status quo in Syria for the last 4 years into more worries about the possibility of a clash between the party involved in Syria. I see Vienna is to organize or to coordinate between the conflicting parties in Syria rather than finding a solution for Syria. It is just for to avoid a confrontation, a larger confrontation between, let's say, the states and the Russians, or the Saudi and the Russians, rather than doing a solution for Syria itself. In principle, if regional countries cooperated together, they could have developed a solution not only for Syria but for throughout the Middle East. It is very orthodox for somebody to say, why don't you, the Saudis and the Iranians, sit together and work out your differences? But it is, and I'm sure if Mohammed Zarif was here, he would walk in, he will tell us stories about how many initiatives he did and how many messages he sent to the Saudis to start a dialogue with them. But while he is saying that, his forces are killing Syrians in Syria. And that's what the Saudis see. The Saudis sees the Iranians violent military intervention in Syria that makes Saudi Arabia very much suspicious and not interested in talking with the Iranians, because the Iranians are doing war while they want to talk peace. So in principle, that look very naive to us to accept sitting and discussing to us, the Saudis, to sit and have a dialogue about a peace in Syria while the war machine is its own. I want to draw a map of the major countries in the region that in principle should have worked together to put an end to the crisis throughout the region, not only Syria. How we can, if we understand where those countries stand, we can understand their positions of today. I will divide those countries into two groups. A group that see priority to countering Arab Spring, counter-revolution. They see Arab Spring as the danger for the region. And the countries who fall in that categories are Iran, by their support to Bashar al-Assad because they refuse change, United Arab Emirates, and Egypt. Saudi Arabia was there, alhamdulillah. We are moving toward the other group, the one who see more importance to stop the chaos in the region. And I think this group are the one who begin to understand history better. I see Saudi Arabia now in a leading position in that group, Qatar and Turkey. But both groups, they share a common interest in fighting terrorism. But they differ on how to begin. Some countries take a confused position, like United Arab Emirates. They are for fixing the situation in the Middle East. What they do, they are in partnership with Saudi Arabia in Yemen. But in the same time, they want the result in Yemen to fit with their agenda of countering a result of Arab Spring. So they want Yemen to be free from the Houthi, but not to fall in the hand of Al-Islah Party, for example, which I think it is inappropriate of any country to decide on behalf of the Yemeni people what to do in the future. So if we understand this map very well, we can understand the position of all those countries who should be cooperating together, but in reality they are not. Thank you.
I'm also quite pessimistic about the talks in Vienna. The history of civil wars, I think, tells us that they don't end easily. The warring parties, they really have to feel that view that they have exhausted all other options, and they have to think that they cannot defeat the other party militarily. And also, I think the international actors involved in the conflict, they have to be on the same page. And they're not. Even from the Turkish perspective, for instance, Turkey and U.S. are allies, they are on the same front, and yet even they are on the same page. They have different priorities, so they have different visions, and they even have different visions for a post-Assad Syria. And that complicates things and makes a resolution more difficult. Before the elections, Turkish elections in June, I think the ruling party, the AKP, signaled a change in its Syria policy after having resisted since 2011. Finally, Turkey said that, well, maybe Assad could play a role in a transition, and that was a big step for Turkey. And I think that was mostly dictated by the facts on the ground. But considering what happened in most recent Turkish elections in November, the AKP captured almost 50%, and now it has a stronger mandate. So the ruling party might read the results as almost a support for its, in my view, failing Syria policy. So I don't think it will back down on its red lines. And those red lines really complicate not just the situation and the conflict in Syria, but also its relations with its allies in Syria. So those red lines were Assad has to go, and it has to be the priority. And that is something I think that's not really shared by the Americans. They, when they look at Syria, they see the Islamic State as a bigger threat. On the other hand, Turkey thinks that Islamic State is just a symptom. The root cause is the Assad regime, and without tackling that, you cannot really do anything about the Islamic State. And the second red line, Turkish red line, is the Kurdish forces, Syrian Kurdish forces. I think from the get-go, Turkey built its Syria policy on its fear of Kurdish irredentism. So it always tried to marginalize the YPG, the PYD, which is the Syrian offshoot of the PKK. And I think that undermined American interest and also Turkish interest in Syria. Turkey constantly put pressure on the Syrian opposition not to talk about granting rights to the Kurds, so that was one of the reasons why the Syrian Kurds did not become part of the Syrian opposition. And I think if they could, I think we could have, the facts on the ground could have been different. So I don't think Turkey is going to back down on its position of the PYD. It still considers that as a terrorist organization. And as you all know, the U.S. has been working closely with the PYD. In Kobani, the U.S. administration airdropped weapons to the PYD because it has become almost the ground force of anti-ISIS coalition. It's doing a great job. It's become the most effective fighting force against the Islamic State. And now the Russians are also in the picture, and they have been trying to engage the PYD. And I think it was a few weeks ago when the PYD leader, Salih Muslim, was talking about opening an office in Moscow. And also there are reports, Turkish media reports, that Iranians are also trying to engage the PYD. So the PYD is there, and everyone who is very concerned about the rise of the Islamic State want to engage the PYD, but Turkey is trying to marginalize the PYD. So on the one hand, you have a U.S. administration working very closely, coordinating its attacks with the PYD and considering providing weapons to the PYD. On the other hand, you have a very close American ally, Turkey, that is bombing the PYD targets in northern Syria. And considering the breakdown of ceasefire between the PKK and Turkey domestically in July, I think things are going to get even more complicated because Turkey has been bombing the PKK targets in northern Iraq, and now the Turkish government's biggest priority is that fight. In November elections, the ruling party received nationalist votes, and that's how it could be able to increase its votes 9 points. So it has the nationalist votes, and that nationalist constituency wants the government to keep fighting, to keep attacking the PKK. And I think that's what the Turkish government will do. But that will in turn complicate Turkey's strategy because it cannot keep fighting against the PKK domestically and engage the PYD in Syria. So I think there is a big problem here. Either the anti-ISIS coalition has to find another ground force that can fight as effectively as the PYD has against the Islamic State. And there are debates that, well, there is this new force, Syrian Democratic Forces, the majority of which, by the way, is the Kurds. But there is a debate on working with the Arab coalition, but almost everyone who follow Syria agrees that you cannot do this alone with the Arab opposition. So the Kurds have to be there, and Turkey obviously is a very important country, and it has to be part of the diplomatic efforts in Syria, but it does not see eye to eye on a very important issue with its Western allies. So I think all these things make the situation very complicated, so I'm very pessimistic about the Vienna talks.
I'm also very pessimistic about the Vienna talks, but I would say this is the most optimistic I have been, because I find it very positive that Iran has been included in the process, and I think that Iran's inclusion in the Geneva talks should have happened much earlier. But the reason I think it's positive for Iran to be included in these talks is, you know, for multiple reasons, and it doesn't all come back to the issue of Syria. Of course, Syria is the main subject of the talks, and of course, very significant, the conflict, and Iran's role in Syria. Iran sees itself as a key winner in showing its operational capability in sustaining and preserving the Assad regime and sustaining Syria as part of Iran's axis of resistance or its larger regional alliance of states that includes Hezbollah, Iraq. So Syria is a pivotal piece on the chessboard for Iranian geopolitical strategy. But Syria also matters, and Iran's inclusion in the Geneva talks also matters for Iranian domestic politics and for the future of Iranian politics as well, because following the recent nuclear negotiations and the agreement that has been reached, Iran, the Rouhani administration and Iranian Foreign Minister Zarif have basically sold the negotiations as a model for future, the future possibility of the way Iran will interact in the region, the Iran will interact with the United States. So reaching a negotiated settlement in Syria that includes Iran will be very important as a mechanism and means by which Iran is moderated regionally and domestically. And it'll have implications for the future of U.S.-Iran engagement, the future of greater U.S.-Iran working relation together, as well as an important piece to de-escalate the really significant and important Cold War that is taking place between Iran and Saudi Arabia. And without resolving the Syrian part of that peace, the larger struggle for power does not look good. But of course, it's going to be very challenging, and it's going to be very challenging because for the Iranians, basically the position is that the Assad regime has to stay and that Syria has to be and remain part of the axis of resistance, and it really will not move away from that stance. And it will increase its efforts to preserve the Assad regime if necessary, and if the talks don't succeed. And on the other side as well, the Saudi position, I think, Saudi also has to realize that it's important to talk with the Iranians, to negotiate with the Iranians, and try to settle its regional disagreements in a diplomatic manner. And over the past years, I mean, including the nuclear negotiations, Iran's increased influence and reach in the region, from the Iranian perspective, from many perspectives, Saudi has not succeeded in its policies of containing and constraining Iran regionally, and by not reaching an agreement with Iran on its larger larger struggles for power in the region, Iran will only increase its confrontation with Saudi Arabia.
I'm happy to be part of this annual conference. Thank you very much, Wendy. And I'm happy also to be back to Washington, D.C. It brings back wonderful memories. I did my master at American University, PhD at Georgetown. I did my Fulbright here, and I also met my wife here. So you would expect how much I love this this city here. But I'm not very happy to be part of this pessimistic panel. You just heard here. And I like to go beyond this pessimistic narrative you just heard from the big regional power to the rising power called United Arab Emirates. I think that all the major powers in the region today are tired, bloodied, exhausted from all the tensions in the region. But I also see that no one in the region today is in the mood for regional cooperation. Rather, everybody still wants to continue this unhealthy confrontation. And the second point is that even if they sit down like a gentleman, Iran, Saudi Arabia, Turkey, and the others, I think the region has gone way beyond their control. The forces on the ground have a logic of their own, have developed a dynamic of their own, way beyond any control from regional power or global power, by the way. That's where the action is. It's not in Tehran, it's not in Ankara, it's not in Riyadh, it's not in Cairo, it's not even in Moscow or Washington. They have all created forces, created non-state actors, created monsters, small and big ones, and they unleashed them. And these are the monsters that have gone out of control, and they are the ones who are creating facts on the ground and shaping the destiny of this very troubled region called the Arab world, called the Middle East, larger or smaller Middle East. So one has to focus on these little and big monsters and see what these guys are doing, and they're just playing havoc. Extremism, sectarianism of all kinds that we have never seen in recent memory. And hence, I don't think that there is any way on earth that we could predict what is the big next event. What is the next big event for 2016? That's the real challenge. The real challenge is that there is absolutely no one has a clue what is going to be the next big surprise. In the last 5 years, we have seen the Arab Spring out of blue. Nobody expected it. We saw the rise of ISIS. Nobody expected that. We were dragged as GCC into a Yemen conflict, and all of a sudden the Russian has moved in big way and huge, you know, repercussion for Syria and for the region and for everybody else. And I wish somebody in this audience, somebody in the hundreds of think tanks in Washington and all over the world, just tell us what is the next big thing. They spend billions of dollars on these think tanks. They spend billions of dollars in assessments, CIAs and DIAs of the world, etc., and nobody has a clue what would be the next big thing. And I think that's where the focus is, not the regional cooperation, which is not going to happen anytime soon. So it's really a region that is out of control because of all this confusion and because of people and regional powers are tired. And it's probably up to the, not the old regional powers, but maybe it's up to the new rising power, such as UAE. That's probably where we should be looking for how the shape of the region is in the years to come.
Thank you all. Abdul Khalik, I'd like to dig in for a second into something you just said, which I found very interesting. The CIA and DIA, we all, I think, look at their budgets and wonder, my God, what do they spend their money on when they seem to not see Russia moving into Crimea? They seem to not see Russia moving further and further into Ukraine, not the rise of ISIS. But one of the points that had been sort of conventional wisdom for quite some time was Al-Qaeda still wanted to hit outside of whatever borders of countries it was operating in, but the Islamic State less so, that it was focused on holding the territory it had as compared to operating outside its borders. Now, obviously, we saw the downing of the Russian plane over Sinai, further threats from ISIS to carry out attacks in Russia, the bombings yesterday in Beirut. When you talk about other monsters, big monsters, little monsters, ISIS certainly appears to be the big monster. What are the little monsters you're referring to?
Well, leave the conventional wisdom aside always, okay? They don't add up to a thing. In Syria alone, there is 1,500 different militias, armed jihadis there. 1,500 warlords, and it's very confusing. These are the little monsters that you have to contend with, and they are not going to come to Geneva or Vienna or the table, okay? Go to Libya, and how many armed forces do you have there? There is at least 1,600 different armed militias in Libya alone. Do you know how many armed Shiite militias in Iraq? There are tens of them. And you go around the region and there are so much non-state actors armed to the teeth, okay, with massive capabilities, way beyond the capabilities of Syria or Iraq or any of the states in the region. These are the big and the little monsters that are really shaping the very region, the breakup of the states, the confusion, the access of violence that we sometimes see coming to our doors, or the thousands of refugees that are going to. So there are big monsters like Assad and et cetera, and ISIS and Jabhat al-Nusra, but there are so many small ones that are completely, totally have been unleashed, and there's no way to get them back unleashed again.
Paim, I'd like to ask you something from a piece you wrote that the headline alone probably would make many Saudis, many Israelis terrified. The piece you wrote talked about ISIS as a chance to work with Iran, and this was part of the quote, just the opening of it. ISIS presents us with a unique opportunity to reset the Middle East equation, to actively transform regional relations, to bait the Cold War between Iran and Saudi Arabia, and forge a new working relationship with Iran. How do you do the last point of forging a new relationship with Iran without, by definition, further alienating the Saudis, the Israelis, the Emiratis, Kuwaitis, Qataris, and on and on?
Well, I think that's why the Syrian conflict and the Syrian negotiations are quite key, because it would really require all the states of the region and the international community to come together and to agree on not only an outcome, a negotiated outcome and political solution for the future of the Syrian regime and the future of reform in the Syrian regime, but in parallel to that, on opposing extremism and terrorism, and ISIS being the most significant of the terrorist groups that I think regional states and countries such as the United States agree on, that pose a challenge to many countries. So, and I think the implicit and sometimes explicit Iranian position is that we first work on stabilizing Syria, which requires opposing ISIS, and terrorist groups, and then going and reforming Syria, the regime. So that's where the tension lies. The tension lies in the sequencing. Because for Iran and Assad, it's first opposing ISIS, it's first opposing the opposition groups, some of which they consider to be terrorists. Whereas I think for Saudi and for the United States or many other countries, it's first thinking of the political solution for Syria and the way the regime should be changed before we really are able to work on the ISIS case. But I mean, ISIS is very important, I think, in terms of allowing for, I mean, that's the potential that I was trying to highlight, and allowing for a regional coalition to oppose ISIS, because in many ways, ISIS ideology, ISIS, and what ISIS stands for, could be seen as a greater threat to Saudi Arabia than Iran. I would argue that ISIS is not a threat at all to Iran, and Iranians don't see it in that way. In many ways, ISIS has been a blessing and potential for Iran, because ISIS has allowed Iran to increase its leverage and increase its support for militias in Iraq, in Syria, to bolster the Assad regime. Even in terms of ideology, legitimacy, soft power, Iran has now claimed that, look, we're moderate political Islam, we're a rational actor, this is the face of real terrorism and real Islamic extremism. So in many ways, Iran benefits from a kind of constrained and weakened ISIS existing on different political objective levels. Working with Saudi, working with the United States and regional countries to take down an ISIS, I think in that way, Iran's also signaling that we're not just caring about ourselves, but we're willing to work on dismantling a network that could have potential negative ramifications for international terrorism, but also as a threat to the Saudi regime, given that ISIS ideology, which is similar to Saudi ideology, is anti-Saudi monarchy, which could come to really hurt and haunt the Saudi government.
There's a thread in that I'd like to pull at for a moment. Obviously, there's sort of a criminology aspect to people who are not in Iran trying to decipher the comments of different Iranian leaders, especially when they seem to be at odds with each other. There was a fascinating interview with Rouhani this morning in the Italian press in advance of a meeting between him and the Pope, which is itself really interesting. The first time an Iranian leader has been in Europe in 16 years. So just think about the way the world turns. You have an Iranian president sitting down with the Pope. In any event, he talked about how this could lead to normalized ties with the U.S. The Supreme Leader has basically said the opposite. The White House has said both. It has said maybe, not the moment. How do you decipher on the Iranian side comments that do appear to be somewhat directly at odds with each other?
I think that the Supreme Leader's position, so the Supreme Leader is taking a very hard stance on no to U.S. negotiations, no to future dialogue, no to future cooperation. But I think these are part of a concerted strategy to manage the relationship and to manage the way that the opening does happen. I don't think that it's a direct closing of the door to any type of real dialogue and the potential for working with the United States or other countries on regional issues. And I think that's why individuals such as the Iranian President Rouhani can make those statements that could be taken to be at odds with the Supreme Leader. But we saw the same type of relationship and dynamics over the nuclear negotiations themselves. The Supreme Leader, Ayatollah Khamenei, set many red lines that the government did not listen to, and eventually, I mean, the Supreme Leader supported the final reached agreement. So I see the Supreme Leader's position mostly as a position of a negotiating stance and bargaining, and to prevent a quick and rapid deterioration, or from their perspective, a quick and rapid opening of ties without necessarily ensuring and knowing what Iran will get in return. Because for Iran, the issue of U.S.-Iran relationship for Iranian hardliners, for the Supreme Leader, is not just an issue of ideology of whether we should work with the United States or not, but it really comes back to geostrategic interests and reasons. I think that in the hardliner mindset in Iran, Iran thinks that it gains a huge geostrategic advantage and soft power advantage by showing that it's been opposed to the United States and that it stands up to the United States. Because here you have a country in the developing world standing up in their narrative to the most powerful and strongest bully in the world, right? So this is kind of an underdog narrative that Iran, because of taking this anti-U.S. position, is suddenly catapulted onto the global stage as an important power and actor to be reckoned with, right? So if Iran is gaining this strategic position of seeming more powerful or being more powerful as it really is because of taking an anti-U.S. stance, it's not willing to give that up quite easily, right? So within some hardliner mentalities, there's also this paranoia that the U.S. wants to show that it's working with Iran too quickly to undermine Iran's soft power and strategic advantage and showing that we're not working with the United States at all. So that's kind of part of the trick and part of the nuance and complexity of how U.S. and Iran are really able to dance together. And I think that eventually, if a working relationship is forged slowly over time, you may not necessarily see a change in Iranian rhetoric, that there could be a possibility of seeing the Islamic Republic continue to take anti-U.S. positions in many areas, but that they would work on areas where there are common grounds and shared interests.
Gunul, for a while, the Erdogan government had a stated policy of trying to have no enemies, that it would, not that there were people it didn't like, but that it would try to talk to everyone. It would talk to the Iranians, it would talk to the Syrians, it would talk to the Americans, it would talk to the Israelis potentially as a mediator. Is that finished for the break over Assad? Turkey moving much more into the camp of wanting him out. That policy of trying to maintain some type of relationship with all of its neighbors, is that gone?
Oh, that's certainly gone. That was before the Arab uprisings. And I think, to be fair, I think Ahmet Davutoğlu's strategy of zero problems with neighbors policy really worked well until the Arab uprisings. With Syria, Turkey lifted visa requirements. They even held joint cabinet meetings. Turkish companies invested heavily in the Kurdistan regional government. When in the 1990s, Turkey even refused to refer to the KRG as the Kurdistan regional government, instead called it Northern Iraqi regional government. So from there to opening a consulate in Erbil in 2009, that was a huge step, and that was part of Ahmet Davutoğlu's strategy with Iran, for instance. In 2010, Turkey voted against the sanctions against Iran at the United Nations, and that alienated the U.S., but Turkey wanted to engage Iran. So Turkey mediated in regional conflicts and I think did a great job. And trade and investment became part of that strategy. So as the Turkish companies kept investing in the region, in Iraq, in Iran, in Syria, in North Africa, Egypt, Libya, then conflict became less likely. So it was a success story in a way. But I think that all changed with the Syrian uprising. For a while, the uprising started in March 2011, and Turkey refused to take a stand. Turkey refused to change its policy of engaging the Bashar Assad regime despite the mounting pressure on the government, because Turkey had invested heavily in the Syrian regime, and the Turkish government thought that it could use that leverage over Bashar Assad to push a change. And that did not happen. So within a few months, the Turkish government had to change its stance and build its strategy on a huge miscalculation. So in August, Ahmet Davutoğlu went to President Erdogan and said Assad had 6 months. And of course that never happened. But from then on, I think Turkey's Syria strategy changed everything for Turkey. It changed its image. Before the Syrian uprising, Turkey was a very, very popular country. And I remember there was a time when even, and this was after the 1 minute Davos incident where President Erdogan heavily criticized Israel, people started naming their children after Erdogan. So he was that popular. Turkish soap operas were very popular in the region. So there was this new rapprochement with the region. And in a way, Turkey reconnected with the region. But that all changed. So there are several public opinion polls conducted after the Syrian uprising that suggest people in the region think that Turkey wanted to play an effective role in Syria, but could not. But before that, Turkey was seen as this regional superpower. It was a Muslim country, and yet it had a Western identity. So there was an Islamist-rooted government, but on the other hand, Turkish economy was growing, and Turkey was trying to become an EU member country. So it was almost a model for the countries of the region. But with Syria, I think Turkey pursued a failed policy. For a long time, Turkey did not really recalibrate its policy based on the facts on the ground, which made Turkey into a country that is not really capable of forcing change in the region. And Syria, again, Syria has been the test case of Ahmet Davutoğlu's zero problems with neighbors policy. It worked wonderfully. In 1999, the two countries almost went to war. And in 2009, Erdogan and President Bashar Assad was vacationing together in Antalya. And so it was just, there was this huge transformation in bilateral relations. And Turkey, thinking that it had invested heavily, diplomatically, politically, and economically, it could really have leverage over Assad. And it didn't. So I think that really dealt a blow to Turkey's regional image and posed a great challenge for Turkey's regional policy, but not just regional policy, for Turkey's domestic politics as well. So, yes, after the Syrian uprising, no one is now talking about Turkey as a model country or Ahmet Davutoğlu's zero problems with neighbors policy. Many people now refer to that as zero neighbors without problems policy.
It's a good phrase, actually. I kind of like that one. I may write it down and shamelessly steal it for a future article. Jamal, there was something you wrote that had an interesting quote that I wanted just to read very briefly. You talk about Iranian Syria, as a second dagger, one that will remain for centuries, waging one war after another with us. And then Iranians are negotiating to shape the future of Syria as if it was their own country. And I wonder two things. Is that a feeling you think is widely shared both among the Saudi royal family, the Saudi leadership, Saudi populace? And if so, how do you find common ground anywhere with Iran?
I think in Syria, Saudi Arabia will continue and it will totally reject any Iranian's victory there. Bashar al-Assad's victory is an Iranian victory. Why is that? There is a Saudi reason and a Syrian reason. The Syrian reason that for Bashar to win, along with the Iranians and of course and the Russians, it means the win of the minority that will subject the majority into to live under a dictatorship. The majority of the Syrians will refuse from now on the rule of that minority. And it is some problem to deal with in the future in how to build up the new Syria. And that is not a recipe for stability. That means a continuation of strife and civil wars or confrontation between the minority and the majority. And Saudi Arabia does not want a neighborhood like that. So it means it is a strategic goal for Saudi Arabia to let the Syrian revolution succeed so peace will be restored to Syria again. The other reason, which is Saudi, most Saudis, they believe, most Saudis, I would not say all, most Saudis, they believe there is Iranians hegemonial plan for the region. We believe there is two states in the region that still live in those Middle Ages concept of empire building, that you start with from a small principality in Khuzestan, and then you become powerful, you feel able enough to expand and move on and build a dynasty that will last for 200-300 years, and then somebody else will take over, and why are you building your dynasty? You just crush everybody in your way, and you subject him to your will. This is old style of building countries. It is now nobody does that, except Iran and ISIS. That's why I would disagree with Mohsin. There's no way Iran and ISIS will agree, because they believe in empire building, and they believe in this constant state of war between them. It's God given. It is their duty in the front of God to fight on behalf of God, both of them. So that is why Saudi Arabia of course we accept Iran as a neighboring country within the international border of Iran, but we will continue refusing Iran to be a power in Syria or in Yemen. And in that article you referred to, I was referring to that concept of useful Syria. That state, if it is created, it will be like Israel. It will have to be always living behind walls. It will be in a constant state of war with its neighbors, because it is not acceptable to the Syrian people. Can you imagine a sectarian state in Syria and the reaction of the majority of the Syrian people to it? So that state, that sectarian state, also is not viable. It doesn't have the reasons for success except, again, by force. That's how Israel is surviving in the Middle East. It is surviving in the Middle East not by persuasion and negotiations. It is by its might, by its force. So will be Iranian Syria, as I described it in my article. It has to live by force and subject whoever under its domination to the force. And another reason why this recipe is impossible: there will never be a pure sectarian state in Syria. Right now, in the coastal area, there are about 1.5 million Sunnis there. And maybe they will make more than half of the population in that sectarian state. Those Sunni Muslims, they are also part of the revolution, even though they are living today under Bashar al-Assad. You take an organization like Ahrar al-Sham, it is not only a military organization, it is a civil organization that administers areas that it liberated inside Syria, and it also a clandestine political movement that it has links inside al-Assad territories. That's why you hear of mass arrest in areas that controlled by al-Assad, because they discover cells in Latakia or in Tartus who are allied to Ahrar al-Sham or to other resistant groups. So again, that is another reason why that Iranian state could never survive in Syria, just a recipe for a continuation of war.
Paim, it's very easy, I think, sitting in Washington, for people to look at Iran and see it as this invincible force, constantly rising, maneuvering pieces around the Middle East, kind of like it's a chessboard, and that the U.S. is always lagging behind. And that, again, is sort of a narrative taking hold. At the same time, you are seeing evidence of the kind of price Iran is paying financially, in terms of what it pays to support Assad, in terms of people, the number of generals who are being killed, even those that are being publicized, one would presume there are some who are not being publicized, and then the kind of attacks we saw yesterday in Beirut, which are clearly an attempt to hit Hezbollah, but by extension, to hit Iran. Is there a point at which you think the cost can be made high enough to Iran that, one, its policies may change generally, but two, it looks for some type of common ground with the Gulf states, with Saudi Arabia?
Thank you. No, thank you for that question, because that actually allows me to respond to some of Mr. Khashoggi's remarks on Iran, because it's really that the narrative of this expanding imperialist empire building Iran is just not true. I mean, it's just not false. And in order to understand Iran's strategy, I mean, you really need to understand how Iran approaches issues of national security. And unlike countries such as Saudi Arabia and the Gulf countries that spend billions of dollars on purchasing military equipment, on spending on their security agencies and military agencies, several times more than Iran spends nationally. Iran chooses a very cheap, cost-effective means, and that's to support guerrilla groups across the region. So that also comes back to your question on Iran's strategy and the cost. Iran is taking a very cost-effective approach. It's supporting very small
very inexpensive types of groups that require minimal funding, minimum types of weapon requirements that are socially supported, that have grassroots capacity. So Iran in many ways is it's undertaking, it's kind of, it's modeled from the Iran-Iraq War, it's undertaking its own indigenous state building from the ground up. And it's supporting those groups that have the capacity and capability to do that. And it's developing strong sources of connection and linkage and leverage with these groups, which then play into Iran's larger regional deterrent strategy, right? Iran doesn't want to fight other countries or Israel or United States in its own borders. It's going to try to fight them externally in the region, or it's going to try to create deterrent capacity to make sure that if there's going to be any type of aggression against Iran, that states know that Iran has capacity of retaliating outside its borders. So it's a very smart, cost-effective strategy. And so that's one reason why you see Iran having influence in the region. Two other reasons is that I think it's a failure of past policy, both by Saudi Arabia and by the United States, to isolate and contain Iran. If the goal is not to integrate Iran into a larger recognized role and security architecture in the region that it can have, you're basically incentivizing, you're giving incentives to Iran to act as a spoiler and destabilizer in multiple conflict arenas. Because the only way for Iran to win is to say, look, I'm still here, I haven't been defeated. Right, so the structural conditions are very conducive to Iranian victory. Iran just does not have to suffer defeat. If Iran doesn't suffer defeat, it's a winner. So that's why it seems that Iran's power is always expanding, because it's just not losing. Not that it's necessarily expanding into an empire. The third reason why you see Iran's expansion is because of U.S. invasion of Iraq. It has nothing to do, it was not an Iranian plan. Iran did not convince the White House to attack Iraq. Iran was opposed to the war, but one of the consequences of the U.S. invasion of Iraq was that it moved Saddam Hussein, who was kind of the main buffer of the Sunni Arab world against Iran, and it shifted the power balance in the Persian Gulf security towards Iran and away from Saudi Arabia. So that's another structural reason why Iran's position has increased in the region. And I would say, in addition to that, and looking into the future as a longer-term trend, we see the collapse of the Arab state system, right? In the future, you're going to have a weakening and severe deterioration of effective capacity of Arab states to govern. That chaos and vacuum of power that's going to be produced will, of course, naturally be exploited and used by regional players, particularly non-Arab neighbors, one of them being Iran, and these are its neighbors. So that's another long-term structural reason why Iran would want to expand. And if there's any country that is in a medieval mindset, I mean, I would say it's the Saudi regime with its particular governance of no elections, women can't drive. I mean, just looking at the Iran, despite all its flaws it may have domestically, I mean, the way it has been able to incorporate Islam in popular elections and have electoral turnovers for the presidency, for the parliamentary, to educate and empower women, is on any indicator not comparable to Saudi Arabia and many Gulf states.
Can I let me go back to you. Let me go to Abdul Khalik first.
Can I, and of course, in the spirit of solidarity with Jamal and GCC and the Gulf here, I have to say this. It's a low-cost Iran strategy, but at a huge cost for the Arab states, okay? Maybe it's very low-cost for you, but it's a huge cost to the Arab Gulf states here. Second is that Iran, of course, is a neighbor, and we respect Iran as a society, civilization, culture, people, etc. But Iran, since 1979, has been a huge headache for the Gulf states and for the rest of the region. It's a difficult neighbor, sometimes more difficult, sometimes less difficult, but always consistently a difficult neighbor throughout history, more so since 1979. But there is a few things that we need to just lay out about how we see Iran of 1979, not Iran of history, but Iran since 1979. This Iran has three pillars that's not going to go away, and it is exactly the kind of things that we watch for. Number one, pillar number one of Iran, 1979, it's a revolutionary Iran. It's an anti-status quo Iran. It's an Iran that supports and funds, etc., radical groups for its own, because that's the part and parcel of the nature of the of Iran 1979. This is ingrained in the very constitution of Iran, by the way, to support the oppressed, meaning mostly Shiites in the region, etc. So revolution in Iran is not going to change, and it is fundamentally a troubling Iran. Second, Iran is also fundamentally, by its very constitution, article number so-and-so, it's a sectarian Iran. It has declared itself to be an Islamic sectarian Shiite, Ithna Ashari, Twelfth or something, Ja'fari. This is ingrained. So sectarianism, Iran, is a huge challenge to us, maybe not to the West, because it allows itself to interfere in our internal affairs. It sees minorities in the region and thinks it is responsible for these minorities. Sectarian Iran, revolutionary radical Iran, and third, Iran has always been, and it will always remain, it's part of their mentality, culture, imperial Iran. It always wants to think big, think itself as a grand power. You know, maybe it's, you know, it's up to them, but that comes at a cost to us, because it wants to act as a policeman of the Gulf, a policeman of the region, a big power of a sort, the political capital of the region. You know, these are the Iran that of the 1979 that is not going to change as a result of the nuclear deal. This moderate Iran, this phantom, this fantasy about moderate Iran because of the deal is only a daydream for somebody in the White House. Not going to go down right for the next 5 years, 10 years, unless something different happens in Iran, unless the Revolutionary Guards or the Khamenei or all these guys are leave the driver's seat and somebody else comes in their place, Iran is going to be these three Iran, revolutionary Iran, anti-status quo Iran, sectarian Iran, imperial Iran, and we are the first, the ones that are going to have to deal with it, and it's going to be massive to deal with Iran. And it's not going to change anything as a result of, you know, Zarif's smile or Rouhani's moderate narrative that you guys hear probably here in Washington, and somebody here in Washington is promoting and marketing these days, moderate Iran. It does not resonate well with us in the region.
There's a lot in that to dig at. I will, however, turn to you to start digging. I'm going to ask two things, and I'm going to really ask the second. First, identify yourself, please, by name, by affiliation. Secondly, and this is most important, keep the questions as short as possible. Don't think of them as Facebook posts with a question mark at the end. Think of them like tweets, short, concise, so that as many people in the room can ask questions as possible. And again, that's important. Time is of the essence, so really please do keep the questions brief. Let me start over here on the right.
Hi, Ethan. Ethan Field, former Marine and current graduate student in D.C. My question is to Mr. Mohseni. Former U.S. Marine and American citizen Amir Hikmati has been imprisoned in Iran on baseless charges for 4 years at this point. With the desire for detente with Iran in mind, how does the U.S. move forward with the political imprisonment of many of our citizens in Iran? Thank you.
Should I answer now?
Yes, please.
Okay. So thank you for your question. Yes, the detainment and imprisonment of Iranian Americans on recently Lebanese Iranians is quite significant, and just recently you've seen an upsurge in the detainments that have been happening. I would say that, of course, while very troubling, it's part of a larger strategy, as I described earlier, of U.S.-Iran engagement, of one, Iran retaining and what it sees to have bargaining chips in a larger U.S.-Iran dialogue that could take shape in the future. But it's also to chance to send, very importantly, a chilling effect domestically to from the Supreme Leader and the hardliners, the IRGC, to say, be careful not to push for reform too quickly.
be careful not to engage with the U.S. and the diaspora too quickly and too suddenly, and that any type of rapprochement or opening or any consequence that could follow the nuclear agreement has to be managed and has to be politically acceptable for all factions. Because basically one of the implications of the nuclear agreement, which we're not able to speak about today, is what will Iran's status be 10, 15 years from now? And part of that larger debate is the future evolution or potential the future evolution of the Iranian domestic political scene, right? So those issues come back to the domestic struggles and domestic competition between different Iranian political factions and power holders in their larger struggles for the future evolution of the Islamic Republic.
In the interest of time, I think I'll bundle a few questions together at once. So let's start here with the first of those.
My name is Havi Buzo. I'm the Bureau Chief of Orient TV in Washington. Can I have two questions?
If they are short enough to combine into one.
Okay. Just start with Mr. Mohaisni. I just wanted to talk about your point when you said that Iran and kind of you said that Saudi Arabia's regime is the Middle Age or Dark Ages regime. I want to talk about why don't you mention the Iranian funding in support of Al-Qaeda and even the sort of collaboration they have in Syria today. And obviously that's when we talk about, the fact that in Iran they stone women to death until today. And then obviously the revolution in Iran. We don't hear you talk about the people in Iran struggling. They execute Kurds on daily basis in Iran. There's the Sunnis are being oppressed in Iran. Why don't you talk about these things? The second question is for Mr. Jamal Khashoggi. You're a very well-known and very well-respected in the Arab world as an expert. I want to ask you about the Mr. Zubairi's last comments about saying that Assad would only be toppled by, political negotiations or by force. Why does Mr. Zubairi keeps on saying those things, and how do you feel that the Saudi Arabia's government will be able to implement such a thing, given right now that Russia is actually intervening in Syria? Thank you so much.
Thanks. Let me just add one more question, and we'll try to get those answered as a pair.
My name is Abdullah Hindawi. I'm from George Mason University. My question to Mr. Jamal, because the sense I get from your talk is that Saudi Arabia is a regional supporter of human rights. And I'm honestly questioning this because I thought Saudi Arabia is the country that hosted bin Ali of Tunisia once he fled. And Saudi Arabia is the country that pledged unlimited financial support to Sisi after he staged the coup. And also Saudi Arabia is the country that is trying to crack down on its own democratic forces as well as its in forces in Bahrain and in Yemen and so on. So the sense to get like Saudi Arabia is a pro-democracy in the region, while Saudi Arabia itself is a country that counter democracy in many senses. I myself was a protester in Tahrir Square for 18 days and on, and I would never at any second, at any moment had a thought that Saudi Arabia would be one day supporting democracy, a country that itself is not believing, yet it is demonizing democracy and democratic forces. I would never ever imagine that Saudi Arabia one day would be defending my own right as a citizen somewhere else. Saudi Arabia was never, at least in my own assessment, was never a country that would support democracy. So please, when we question the idea of democracy in Saudi Arabia that doesn't like dictatorship in Syria, let's first look at what Saudi Arabia is doing in its own country. Thank you.
So let me turn to you, because in some ways there were two questions embedded in Saudi Arabia. Let me turn to you on the first and then time on the second. Or Abdul Khalaq, please feel free to jump in as well.
Right, for Adel al-Jubair insisting that Bashar al-Assad must go by peace or by force, that is Saudi Arabia showing its determination to put an end to Bashar regime and Iranian hegemony in Syria and in the region. Even though with the Russian intervention in Syria, we are determined to, our path did not change. And I began to see something like what we did in Afghanistan. While Saudi Arabia is negotiating with the world in Vienna, it is stepping up aid and support to the Syrian rebels who are calling for democracy. and power sharing. Saudi Arabia.
Please, let's allow answers to the Syrian rebels.
I'm saying Saudi Arabia never promote or advocate democracy for others. But when you have people who are demanding democracy, who are fighting for their rights, we happen to stand by them. So we should be proud of that. And you should be proud of this. We are siding with the Syrian people's choice. We did not tell the Syrian people to go on the street and demand democracy. But the Syrian people are receiving that warmly, and most of the Syrian people, they appreciate that from Saudi Arabia. But Saudi Arabia is not the one who started the revolution in Syria, but we are standing by the revolution in Syria, and we should be appreciative of that.
Abdul Khalik, I think you'd wanted to jump in as well.
Just very briefly, at the end of the day, whether it's democracy or not democracy, is people's choice, okay? And when Egypt decided to elect in a very free election that they never had in all of their history, the first country to recognize Morsi's government and Muslim Brotherhood were Saudi Arabia, United Arab Emirates, and the Gulf. And when Tunisians went into the poll and they elected their own government, the first country in the world to recognize them and extend the invitation for the leaders to come and visit UAE, Saudi Arabia, and the Gulf, were the Gulf states, okay? So this notion that Saudi Arabia is not a democracy or the Gulf states is not democracy is nonsense. This is our own business, okay? But when the people of Egypt or the people of the region decide to go democracy, so be it. Because democracy is a long process. It's not going to come overnight. And we don't know in 10 years, 20 years, whether Egypt will be democracy. It's never going to be a threat to the Gulf states who are going through their own process of change and political modernization. So I think this notion that the Arab Gulf states are not democratic and hence anti-democracy are just doesn't make sense, by the way.
I suspect we'll be getting more questions on both Iran and Saudi Arabia. Yeah. There'll be other questions on Iran. I would like to move a little bit. Again, let's start here. And please,
my name is Hassan. I was born in Tehran. I have a Global Bridges for Humanity organization which promotes talk, not using guns and force. Now, I know that in this town for the past few years, Iran bashing has been a game. So everybody from every other direction, they come and either have the information or not information, they bash that country that changed the course of the whole world in 1979, showed that if you do not obey the others, you can stand on your feet. It's been 37 years. Now, what I'd like to ask my brothers and my sister over there at the panel, why are you so resistant to the group of people that they put their lives online, they have succeeded in revolution, they push that country to forward knowledge, science, military, self-sufficient to a point that the whole world came to stop them by saying, look, you're going to make a bomb. And Iran said, we're not going to make a bomb. And finally, they did agree to not to make the bomb, that they were not going to make the bomb. And the world agreed not to attack them because they could not attack them. So the question is this. When are you going to accept Iran as a good neighbor? What's wrong with having a good neighbor? What's wrong with having a very strong neighbor?
Let me cut you there, because I feel like there will be people who will take issue with many parts of that question. But let me turn to you as well, and then we will turn it back to the panel.
You bet. Chris Bauman from National Defense University. The subtitle of the panel is Challenges of Rebuilding Regional Stability, and I suppose that implies that there was a time when it was stable. It's not entirely clear to me when that was, but just for the sake of argument, let's say it was kind of the Cold War period. You know, that stability was maintained by a whole series of, I would say, as Professor Abdullah said, large monsters, you know, great humanitarians like Saddam Hussein, et cetera. Is that really what we want to restore, or is there a different vision of that? And since we're in Washington, D.C., what should the United States' role be in that? Should we be more engaged, less engaged? How, specifically? Thanks.
Thank you for those questions. And Payam, let me start with you, since there were a wave of Iran questions from different directions, actually, which was interesting.
Right. On the first question, I'd say that I'm not in any way, excuse me, saying that there are no problems in Iran, everything's rosy, everything's good. I'm just saying the Iranian political system, despite all the flaws it has, it's still much more participatory. It's much more empowering of individuals. It's much more politically, socially dynamic and diverse than the Saudi government, the Saudi regime, which has no elections, right, which has no mass mobilization, participation, parties, groups, any types of women's empowerment issue. I'm just comparing those two, that Saudi Arabia does not have a viable political model of governance. That's my only point. And the other question on, the other question, I think what I would say is that I think that the nuclear negotiations are important because of the opportunity they can give us, more so, I mean, just as important as the freeze and the challenge of nuclear proliferation. I think that the nuclear negotiations, the nuclear agreement that was reached, is just as important for the opportunity and the doors it can open for actually engaging in Iran and changing the status of Iran's position in the region and for moderating Iran's behavior. Of course, that will be very tricky, very, very contingent on many different conflicts and struggles that are happening. I mean, that's kind of the difficulty, and that's what the larger trend that we're going to have to look at is, you know, how does the Iranian political system, Iran regional policy, domestic policy evolve over the 10, 15 years? And on this issue, U.S. strategy and U.S. actions will be very important.
Before I open the panel to the second question, I do want to follow up on one point because it was an element of the first question that came in. She had raised the notion of Iranian ties or support for Al-Qaeda, which obviously is not normally the narrative is Saudi ties or Gulf ties.
Right.
If you could address that, but also more broadly, Iran is a group, a nation, excuse me, that funds proxies effectively. I agree with you.
Right.
But Hezbollah, you know, you mentioned that some of the militias are low cost, low influence. Hezbollah is better organized, better armed, better funded, and more tactically proficient than almost any Arab army in the last 30 years. So how do you square that? First, was there support that you're aware of towards Al-Qaeda? Secondarily, the powerful armies that Iran is supporting, can those be brought back, put back on a leash, to use a phrase that was used earlier?
I do not know about Iran Al-Qaeda ties, so I would not be able to speak on that. The only thing I would say is that unlike ISIS, from my knowledge of Al-Qaeda, Al-Qaeda did not take a larger sectarian agenda. So that was one of the differences between Al-Qaeda and ISIS, in that ISIS never played the anti-Shia card. So there may have been something, not in terms of support, but there may have been dialogue or contact on that area. On your second point of can Iran kind of use its leverage to manage these other groups, I would say yes. I think one of Iran's capabilities and effectiveness, unlike Saudi Arabia or Gulf state support for different proxies or opposition groups, is that Iran has much more stronger restraining and leash capabilities to manage and not say order, but strategically to decide on what conflicts to engage in and where to stop the conflict.
Let me open to the rest of the panel. I thought very smart question that came in from the other side. What should the U.S. role be? What can the U.S. hope to achieve? What could it achieve? Maybe we'll start at the end. Abdul Khalik.
What could the U.S. hope to achieve?
What should the U.S. role be? What should the U.S. be doing now in the region that may not be doing to try to move it to a more stable place?
Well, the U.S. is very busy with the election and with the Trumps and with everything else, so I don't think there is much that they could do these days, as we heard from the first panel this morning. But no, I mean, there is the action and there is the inaction that the U.S. could do. And in both ways, over the last 10 years, whether it's an action or inaction, U.S. has mismanaged the region. The action meaning 2003, when they went into Iran and into Iraq and see what they have left behind us. An Iraq that is completely sectarian, divided, weak, and is going to be in perpetual instability for the next 5-10 years to come. and thanks to the U.S. So when you do something, do it right. That's first. The second is there is also the American inaction in the region. There is plenty of it, even especially during Obama. And the most tragic one was the inaction in Syria, and see what they have done in Syria. So they left a situation that is in total chaos and full of human tragedy. So both your action and your inaction over the last 10 years has been disaster for the region. And if we go back all the way to the 1940, 45, and your support of Israel and your other mistakes in the region, starting from Afghanistan all the way, the record shows the U.S. had never got it right.
There's a danger to being the one person standing between hungry people and lunch. So that will have to unfortunately be the last word. I hope you can join me, please, in thanking the panel for what I thought was a very interesting discussion.